Families, caregivers, clinicians, educators, researchers. If you care about how children eat, you're not at the edge of this work, you're at the heart of it. This is the care we share. Join us at the Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit, August 21st, and bring a friend. Experience the summit together and grow the understanding our families depend on. The group rate for two or more is $105, CEUs included. Learn more and register at feedingmatters.org/psych-summit. That's feedingmatters.org/psych-summit.
Presented by Feeding Matters, with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Feeding Does Matter. I'm Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
And I'm Haley Estrom. I'm an associate professor in the School of Nursing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington.
Hi, Haley. I just have to giggle because I feel like if everybody saw the chaos that happens before we press record, it would be so funny. But you're with us. Technology's working. It's all good.
Okay. I'm just not sure how I'm coming through. So I hope it's all right.
Our audience will either hear Haley really, really loud or really, really soft. But I hear you great. I think you're good.
Excellent. Well. Let's have a great podcast.
Perfect. Which is actually great because we're with two of our super, super close friends and colleagues today. And we've got Kyler Romeo. Yeah, that one was Kelsey. And Kelsey Thompson.
There's a train going by. Sorry. The train tracks are really close.
Oh, it's so funny. It's the perfect way. I was like, a podcast on Friday always has like randomness like this. So Kelsey and Kyler, you guys are now officially like recurring guests multiple times over. So excited to have you both. And we are talking about your new publication. So Kelsey, how about you start us off? Maybe for those that may not have heard your previous sessions, maybe do a little bit of who you are. Before you dive into the paper itself.
Okay. I'm Kelsey Thompson. I'm a speech-language pathologist and a researcher and adjunct professor. And so my primary research area is supporting families early in their PFD journey through kind of like the early intervention ages. And also the other segment of research is looking at provider preparedness to assess and treat our little ones with PFD.
Kyler, go for it.
Okay. My name's Kyler Romeo, and I'm the Director of Strategic Initiatives. And I'm also an occupational therapist by trade, so Kelsey's counterpart. And I work clinically in a level 4 NICU here in Tucson, Arizona. And it was just such a fun study to get to do together because Kelsey is not only passionate about early intervention, but preparing the workforce, right? Making sure that we have educated and trained providers in order to help the families that are starting their journeys.
I love how we've got this bi-coastal thing going right now. Wow.
Too.
Virtually between North Carolina and Arizona.
Except I think I want to be in North Carolina right now. I don't know.
Yeah.
We're in the monsoon season.
I'm feeling great over here right now.
Yeah, which is pretty nice. I mean, we were 110 and now it is only 95. Be jealous.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. But we have trees down everywhere too because of all the monsoons.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that publication that
Kelsey
recently.
You've had many on this topic in general, but what's the one we want to talk about today?
Yes, we are talking about the new publication that just came out about the focus groups that we completed. It's open access for anyone who's listening and wants to read it. It's available. And really what we were hoping to do is address a few gaps in the literature. So one is that Feeding Matters did the big provider survey, and we had questions after that that we wanted to get more information on. But also we had some literature showing that like SLPs and OTs feel underprepared to assess and treat PFD, but we were missing professionals from the other domains. And we also didn't know what ongoing training looks like. So what happens not only during your academic program, but how do you feel and how do you address competency afterward? And so that was really the purpose of this study. A long-term goal of it was, could it help us prioritize future efforts toward, you know, creating a more competent workforce to assess and treat kids with PFD? And focus groups were a great way to do this because we were able to get people from the different domains all in the same place at the same time, hear people's different perspectives and experiences, and also hear how they kind of bounced off of each other hey, this was my experience and that reminds me of something in someone else's domain. And we also were very specific about making sure we got people from a lot of different settings as well. So not only multidisciplinary, but also not just in a medical setting or just in an outpatient setting.
I kind of thought of this publication as is another chapter in this story for education, because we started with the big, massive provider, you know, the national provider survey, which looked at lots of different areas that we could explore to potentially improve care. And after that study, then we did this cross-section where we really dove into what does mapping academic or educational preparedness, specifically of OTs and SLPs, to gather a bit more knowledge on where the needs were. And this, to me, is like chapter three, right? Where we took a deeper dive because we were really interested in hearing from, like what Kelsey is saying, a variety of voices, because we know it's such a heterogeneous population. PFD is so heterogeneous. And the educational needs of providers is also heterogeneous as well, and academic needs. And there's so many different points of contact where we learn in order to improve our skills and our competencies. And we were just really interested in knowing, like, where are the pain points? Where are the opportunities? And what I love about this publication is that there are some takeaways that we'll get to, like diving into. But Kelsey, I'm sure you were about to kind of look at what were those big, broad themes that we discovered from the publication. I'm doing the focus groups too.
Yeah. And one question I had before we got to the themes was, like, I think focus groups were so interesting and the way you all went about it was interesting. You mentioned, Kelsey, kind of like the multidisciplinary approach and really thinking about getting that like wide grouping of different professionals. How did you both approach the focus groups? Because the national survey was so big, but this allowed you to really get really deep with a lot of various different perspectives. Maybe share a little bit about kind of that approach that you both took.
Yeah. I mean, we went back and forth for a while between, like, do we try to put all of the disciplines in one focus group or different? And ultimately, we decided to do that, to try to get someone from each discipline as much as possible with scheduling into each focus group. And we felt like it was really important not only to hear everyone's experiences, but for other disciplines to hear each other's experiences. It was a little bit of a Tetris situation to recruit people from the different disciplines, because we were trying to, you know, in one focus group, we want to have different disciplines. And then we also don't want them to all be from the same setting. And we wanted them to be like providers who are on the ground. So not voices that we hear from a lot already, but people from the Feeding Matters community who might not otherwise be participating in a lot of research or have a commercial product, you know, more people who are just practicing clinicians. We were kind of trying to avoid like leaders in the field for this particular project.
You can really see the influence of our desire to have community representation, even in our sampling methodology, because that's what we really want to know is, like, people that are out there working with families and children day to day, what does that experience look like? You know, how are they doing and what do they need? And that went back to, and that's represented in the sampling, I would say.
Can you talk a little bit about how, like, just moving from the survey, which is, you know, quantitative and set, how you were able to learn more from doing the focus groups, you know, like what the general purpose and
you know, how you're able to get more from doing types of interviews like this? Like the quality of the information and what you're able to learn just broadly.
Yeah, I think that we got a lot of nuance and context that we wouldn't get from a survey. So a lot of the questions that we asked to the focus groups came kind of directly from, we saw this in the survey, but we don't really understand why that was the response. And so that is our question for the focus group so that we can get those more like balanced and full answers about the questions that we had. And we kind of broke it into the journey as a whole. So we asked questions about academic preparation and we moved into assessment and treatment and reflection. So we kind of like followed the clinical process, but in a more qualitative way. The other thing that I think we were able to dive into more with the focus groups is integrating the family perspective. It came up, we didn't actually ask specific questions about it until the end, but it came up right from the very beginning, which was something we didn't necessarily like expect or plan for, but is just an example of something that like wouldn't have come out in a survey when you think you're asking about, you know, just like, what's your ideal assessment? But then it just really traveled through the whole focus group.
Mm-hmm. I actually found that very encouraging that people were talking about families and outcomes for families and being really, I would say like ethically locked in to understanding that the family is really their, that's their litmus test. That's their measure of success. And what was also encouraging is that we saw that across all disciplines. And we saw that across all practice settings as well.
Yeah, I think that was something that came through a lot in the publication too, in the, you know, in the writing process before it was even published. And then like the, this final version was how much it was truly like a thread throughout. And so that it's great to know that like, not only did you have that question set for the focus groups itself, but then that it came up even as an outside element that came up even before you started asking about it, which I think is a great way to show where the field's at in general. So you listed in the publication, we listed in the publication, the theme summaries. So maybe Kelsey, take us through each of them. And then Kyler, like if you've got thoughts based on your perspectives from the focus groups, because you two were so pivotal in being the leaders of this effort.
Yeah. So we had four themes that came out of the focus groups as a whole. The first one was the differences in academic preparation. And the themes of this theme was not terribly surprising probably to anyone who's listening, which was that everyone feels underprepared after their academic training. It doesn't matter what discipline you're in. Everyone was pretty universal in feeling underprepared. And that was regardless of the intensity of their academic training. So there's a lot of variation in how, you know, like the number of years of training that's required to practice under each discipline. And it didn't really matter if you were on the lower or higher end of that. However, and I don't know if we want to jump into the opportunities for each or do you want.
Well, we could even talk a little about like the differences in the discipline, which I found interesting that the OTs and the SLPs had more awareness or exposure just within their academic pursuits. And that they are like SLP is master's, OT entry is master's and now has a doctorate. We are still representing the, you know, the least amount of like education, right? A master's requirement to practice. Versus our physicians who are the terminal degrees who do not have typically any exposure. That's what we saw. So we saw the OTs and the SLPs with more exposure and I would say a budding awareness of this practice area. And then we had the RDs, our dietitians and the physicians that reported most often of having no exposure
not even the awareness or the entry point or anything to PFD. I found that interesting, even when you're looking at like the depth and the breadth of the education.
Yeah, I agree. It's because I think it's challenging to identify and really look into either problems or solutions in this field because of how many different disciplines are involved, how many settings are involved, and you all did a nice job of really trying to think through and leverage all of those different variables to kind of chart a path forward. And so, yeah, the theme summary being differences in academic preparation, what do you feel like the opportunities are there for someone who may be interested and is younger and is seeing this come out and is wanting to figure out like, okay, how do I kind of take charge of my future path to support my patients?
Yeah.
Do you want to go ahead, Kelsey?
No, go ahead.
Well, it was despite the differences in the academic preparation, I would say universally, if everybody has like one takeaway, yes, we all know that we do not leave our academic programs prepared to competently work with children and families with PFD, right? So that's really already opening and setting the stage that we have responsibilities as providers to continue our education after our programming. So I feel like everybody's pretty hopefully locked in and established that that's, you know, an acceptable norm that we need to then use to leverage for further education. But if you go back and look at what people were sharing underneath this topic area, I thought positively people identified learning structures or types that were more helpful to them than others. And the first thing that they indicated is that when they received a lecture or education from a clinician in the field, that was more impactful for their learning. And it just really opens an opportunity for so many of our providers that are out there doing this work, where they can have this beautiful feedback loop to their academic programs to be providing education and support to the emerging clinicians by sharing their own expertise with support of their academic partners and how to structure their lectures to make sure it's fitting the criteria of the university, make sure that they're, you know, providing information that is at the appropriate learning level of the students. So I just see this as such like a symbiotic opportunity in between the universities and the clinicians that are out there doing the work. It was really impactful to people to hear from providers in the field when it came to children with PFD.
Yeah, and I would say similarly, a lot of providers mentioned opportunities for like clinical observation as being very impactful. So even if you didn't have a lecture on PFD, being able to see a clinician who's treating it, whether it was through an externship or just even just an observation, things like that were really helpful. Again, it was like, if people had at least some exposure, it didn't have to be a full class. And a lot of providers talked about, like, we know our academic programs are full. We have a lot to cover in a limited amount of time. We're not expecting, you know, in-depth education on every single disorder that we could possibly see. But if they had exposure to PFD, it just set them up to know where and how to seek out additional training in the future, regardless of what practice setting they went into. So if they knew it was an area that they might run into in clinical practice or learned that it was something they were really interested in, they were just set up better for the future. Which again, like Kyler said, I think is really encouraging because we don't have to, you know, ideally we would get in-depth education. That's not realistic right now, but exposure is even really great and sets people up for greater success moving forward.
Yeah, and it's something that like can actually be done. I think it's really intimidating to think about the need for a full new class or changing some of the academic standards or some of that stuff. But this does give something very doable as it relates to even just a little bit of exposure to this world while still in school.
I think it's also important, that statement that Kelsey shared about how we have to look at what is reasonable for academic programs.
Yeah.
Because they are stacked. I try to, if you just look at the criteria that they have to fulfill for people to be ready to sit for boards or ready to practice. I mean, we're trained as generalists, right? We have to be able to work with any medical or occupational or behavioral challenge, anything. We need to have some baseline competency for that because we're trained as generalists. And sometimes I feel like we can inadvertently villainize our poor academic programs when we're saying, you know, you're not providing this level or this level of background information on PFD. We understand that that is a major, like providing comprehensive education and training is just not reasonable through our academic programs. But we would like to kind of set the stage that we could have exposure.
Yep. So true. And that kind of then, as you followed everybody's exposure into the workplace too, that kind of brought us to your next theme. So Kyler, maybe share a little bit about the summary and the thoughts around workplace infrastructure and what you all found out from the focus groups there.
Well, we found that the practice setting or the workplace infrastructure was really one of the most influential determinants of their ongoing training. So this really leans into those first experience, or even it could be your second, third, fourth, wherever, you know, you enter treatment and intervention for PFD, the workplace matters. It really highlights that our employers have a lot of opportunity to support training and resource allocation to their clinicians that are working with those populations. You know, our employers really have a big foot in the game here because they're responsible for providing evidence-based, comprehensive, and family-centered care for the client, which is then reimbursed or funded by the insurance company. So we have lots of stakeholders that are interested in outcomes for families. And so I think it just sets the stage for them. They have more skin in the game because it really truly is their business. And that may then provide different resources. So if we're looking at our big academic institutions, we found that they had more built-in training pathways, preceptorships, mentorship opportunities, coaching models, resources through being able to get access to our articles through subscriptions so that they could actually have the evidence at their fingertips and other types of opportunities that I'm sure Kelsey can kind of dive into a little bit deeper. But that was in contrast to our providers that are working independently. They may be working for independently owned outpatient clinics. They may be working under state programs such as early intervention that may not have the same level of funding for employee training. And that's where we really started to see the discrepancy, and it almost divided into these two training pathways. And Kelsey, maybe you want to expand on that a bit.
Yeah. So that is kind of was the most insightful thing I think we got, because it was across these different areas that we were looking at, but there was a clear delineation between people who were in more, you know, well-resourced settings, like an academic medical center. They tended to be part of a multidisciplinary team. And like Kyler said, those who are working more independently. For example, people who were on a big team had more mentorship opportunities built in, versus people who are in more independent settings had to be really self-directed with their training, their ongoing training, and invested a lot of their own personal resources, time and money, into doing so because those structured opportunities didn't exist. Like Kyler said, multidisciplinary teams had these like really robust resources for evidence-based practice. Some even had medical fellows or nurses whose roles were just to be like involved in bringing research to the team, where clearly those of us who work in EI or private settings don't have just like a person doing that for us. And it was interesting. We saw when it came to treatment, a little bit more of kind of like trial and error, individualized treatment when it came to independent providers versus multidisciplinary teams who had maybe like practice guidelines to follow. So kind of like a different way to approach treatment between the two of those. And then one other thing was just how we evaluate ourselves. And on bigger teams, there's more formal structures for evaluation. Like they might have quarterly evaluation versus independent providers had a more qualitative approach. And that was a lot based on the family relationship and rapport and feedback they were getting from families versus necessarily like a supervisor.
There's so much I think we could learn from each other and the different approaches to care from those in a more formalized model that have these supports that are provided by quality assurance from the institution, right? Like I think of my own self, I'm in a level 4 NICU. We have identified policies and procedures. We have practice guidelines. There are some guardrails in how we approach intervention pre-feeding into oral into competency with these premature infants versus if when I've also worked in early intervention and was largely on my own and working with families and how in that practice setting, I really leaned into what was happening at the family level, what was happening in the home environment, what was identified by the parent as a source of stress, and then diving into all those other layers to help identify the root cause, but all within through a family lens. And so I just see there's such value in both approaches to care that if we can have more conversations and more melding between the two, oh, I think we just have like opportunity for exponential growth. And that was one of the takeaways that we had from this group is there is an opportunity to develop these communication pathways in between our more formalized institutions and those that are providing care after acute discharge or after like a very structured inpatient or outpatient program. There is a lot of opportunity that exists.
That was going to be my question for you, Kyler, was, you know, and that's the struggle. You kind of find yourself in one setting and that giving you the opportunities or differences in settings of opportunities. What do you feel like someone can do or what some tangible things for someone to do that's out there listening and they're like, oh, I'm in a center and I need to be exposed to kind of the other side, or I'm in a private setting or in early intervention, I need to be exposed to some other opportunities. What are some tangible takeaways for our providers potentially listening?
Go back to like our first levels, which are always awareness and acknowledgement. So we start there across the board, right? When we're looking at how we would like to change any system. So the awareness that care continues beyond your doors, whether you're an in-home provider or you're in the inpatient acute care setting. So first is awareness that whatever we're doing for intervention to help improve that child's relationship with food then has to be applied to participation in real world environments. So, and if we have that awareness, then we have acknowledgement of who is next in the care pathway or who's impactful to that child's integration into that those participation activities. And then I think we need to start establishing communication between all of these different entities. How could the resources from the hospital system also be leveraged to reach our community providers? Like one suggestion that came in from the study was, can we invite our community providers to our medical rounds, to educational opportunities that are offered by the hospital system? Can we create coordination of care pathways where we just have collaborative conversations, which is so much exposure to other models of care and really plant seeds of different thoughts in providers' minds just every time they have a conversation with a different discipline. I think there are some very simple places where we could start. Kelsey, what are your thoughts on what we could do differently?
Yeah, I agree with all of those. And I would say you know, there was really nice collaboration within the focus groups of people being, oh, I would love to be able to see those practice guidelines, or I would love to better understand how you get the family perspective. So it was even happening, like you could see those conversations, how they could happen in the real world as they were happening, like in these small focus groups. I think as a call to researchers, something that came up was people wanting more access to the research articles if they weren't part of an academic medical center where they had access to journal articles. And so I think finding, you know, open access is great, but it's still pretty expensive if you don't have funding in place for that. And so other ways to share research findings is something that was a call from providers, especially those who are in independent settings, but even those who are in academic medical centers, everyone's busy and you want the evidence-based practice, but you want it to be something that's easy to consume and easy to access. And so that's something as a researcher that I heard of, like, oh, yeah, like things like this, where we are sharing about and it's open access, having more of that available and out there was something that providers mentioned too.
And that you said that, Kelsey, because that's really back to shared responsibility. For anyone that's contributing any aspect to the field, our responsibility.
We all have a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. So the next theme that you all had was desire for comprehensiveness and feasibility. Kelsey, maybe you kind of share a little bit more about that one with us.
Yeah, this was like that really balanced understanding of we want it all and we understand that it needs to be feasible. And we touched on a few of these things already. One was, you know, the conflict between wanting really comprehensive education and understanding that there's a lot of information for programs to cover. Wanting a lot of training after they graduate, but there's also like a time and cost component. And then something else that we haven't really touched on yet was assessment we asked them about. And providers really wanted assessment that covered all four domains, but that was easy to complete like quickly. And everyone was like, ideally it would be this, but I understand that it's not feasible necessarily to be able to do all of these things. So it was kind of nice, you know, people are realistic. That was really what came out of this theme is, these are our big dreams and how can we make them feasible for the constraints of, you know, the real world and our actual practice settings and academic programs.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, Kyler, on that too? Because I think it's so much of like, especially even from the Feeding Matters perspective, it's stuff we try to balance a lot too, of like, we have like our dream world scenario and then we have like all the things that we need to get there and this like balance in between and trying to be realistic at the same time is such a layer to it.
I know we keep hearing this call for the gold standard multidisciplinary tool that gives you a beautiful picture across all the domains and family inclusion and provider expertise and puts it all into this beautiful package. And I love that people want that because they realize its importance in determining their own clinical care pathway. So kudos to all the providers and clinicians asking for that. But it just may not look like a universal tool. It may look like assessment mapping, which many of our researchers are tackling, and they're looking at what is available, who is it best for, so that we can have a global picture of what's available as far as tools and assessments, so we know how to pull these pieces together as clinicians to provide a more holistic picture of the family. So I don't think we should ever lose that call for holistic representation of need. We just may have to continue to build the pathway for how that could be achieved.
Yeah, and it seems like everybody was realistic in the focus groups themselves. I mean, I wasn't in them. I saw more of like the stuff on the other side. But as you all are sharing it, there is this understanding that like we're just doing the best with what we currently have, knowing that we want to still keep pushing for better in the future. And then something that I loved that came throughout so much of it was the value of the family perspective. And that's the fourth theme. And so Kyler, maybe share a little bit about that. And Kelsey would love your thoughts too.
We saw the emphasis on this centrality of family goals across all disciplines and across all settings. So hopefully people see that as like we are really putting families first.
At least we have the intention of putting families first, and then we need to continue to build our skill set and the infrastructure in order to do that. But that was from assessment and intervention planning through evaluating effectiveness. And that's where we've really saw it kind of take this stage, is when clinicians were looking at how do they determine if their care is effective. It kept going back to the family's response. Like, did the family value it? Was it meeting their goals? Was the family happy? Universally, people wanted the families to be happy with their care. And then it kind of melded into this other call for improving our ability to give families an avenue to participate in their own care, whether it's participating in the assessment more in depth or intervention. But there was a call for family participation, and perhaps like that's a whole other area where we need to develop our education. And how do we effectively empower families to be sitting along with us? How do we, you know, pull them into care practices? Because in OT, we do cover therapeutic use of self. That's like one of our core, is a core part of MOHO and occupational therapy. But I don't feel like the physicians necessarily get as much exposure to that. Now, that could just be my own perception. Maybe this is our next study where we need to look at like what soft skills are needed.
Can you explain what that means for the disciplines that don't know what therapeutic use of self?
Oh gosh, let me see if I can put that into.
I know we go through that in nursing, and I'm hearing you say you do that in OT, but I don't know if other disciplines do that.
It's recognition that you yourself are a therapeutic agent. You are a modality working with the family. So how you approach them, your attitudes, your beliefs, your recognition of your bias, how you leverage your soft skills, your ability to listen and confirm and provide safe spaces for sharing, all of those soft skills are instrumental in your care delivery. And it's valued just as much as any other intervention, right? Being able to improve oral motor skills, being able to improve swallow initiation, therapeutic use of self is encompass all interventions. I hope that's a good way of explaining it. Haley, you may have a better description from the nursing side.
It's your presence as a provider and how you comport yourself and how you are with them.
As John, our ethics lead for the Center for Feeding Ethics, would say, it's your texture.
Yes.
And how you show up.
How you show up. Yeah.
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 So I know this was kind of your summary theme because there was so much family throughout all of the discussions, but any things to touch on here as it relates to opportunities or any other thoughts you wanted to add for this particular theme, Kelsey?
I think like it was very encouraging that across disciplines, across settings, the family came up over and over again. And there was some really sweet sharing of moments with families that were meaningful and stood out to clinicians that they shared as examples, kind of under each of the areas, which was really nice to hear. And just knowing that I think an opportunity here is giving people kind of like they highly valued family feedback, but it wasn't always clear how to get family feedback, I guess, if that makes sense. And it was addressed differently in different settings. So there were like in medical centers, some people were just like, you know, the hospital just sends out these patient satisfaction surveys and like almost no one answers them versus talking with a family, or like if you're in the home, it was easier to get family feedback or even to intuit it, even if a family didn't feel comfortable sharing, like if they weren't happy with care. So I think that there's an opportunity to kind of explore different ways based on your setting and giving families multiple ways to give feedback I hate conflict. And so even like, if I don't like my dentist or something, I'll just like suffer through and just like stay with the same dentist and never say anything about it. Or just like eventually just like ghost the former dentist and go see a different dentist. And
so an appointment.
Yep. And so I think giving, you know, we saw different ways of getting family feedback and possibly integrating multiple ways for families to give feedback in a way that was most comfortable for them is something that you could, clinicians could think about or explore in their setting. Like, how am I getting family feedback? Is that working for all families? And maybe we can pull from what different ways that different people are doing it across settings.
Yeah, it really highlighted the need for better understanding family satisfaction, and that family satisfaction measure should be a key data point on if we're providing effective care. And it tends to be an add-on versus respected as a key data point for intervention. And so I think we can make some pretty significant improvements in that area across disciplines and across treatment settings.
I have to ask if satisfaction is truly what people want to measure, or if they're really wondering about how much the family member is engaged with care, or if they're engaged the way they truly want to be, or if the outcomes they're seeing are the goals that they wanted for their child. You know, satisfaction could be a lot of different things.
It's not defined.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's a little too squishy.
I agree. Sounds like a study, Haley.
Well, there's always studies, Kyler.
That's actually my next question, because we talked a little bit about this beforehand, but you both were sharing that some of the things that you loved the most about this publication is it's actually like really positive and tangible. And Kyler, you shared that like normally sometimes it's like we just need more research or we just need more this. And it's just like a little bit like doom and gloom. So any thoughts on that in terms of like what your main takeaway from this is and how it makes for something positive for how we're moving this field forward?
I'll share a thought and then I'll kick it over to Kelsey. For me, the key takeaway is that we have the resources and the expertise available. It's in the room. We just need to leverage it a bit differently and keep connecting these various aspects of care. Because if one aspect of care is connected to another, improvements here will trickle down and also have improvements in the subsequent area of care. So some of my key takeaways from the academic side is that we can utilize each other, reaching out to our community providers that are doing the work and having them interact with our students at any and every, you know, level of academic preparedness. Mentorship was such a key theme, and mentorship does not have to be a formal mentorship. That can be like building your network and your community of people that interact with families differently and that are different disciplines, and taking advantage of opportunities for learning that include that community piece. So if you're going to a conference, are you being exposed to a wide variety of disciplines? Is it multidisciplinary? Are there opportunities to chat? Are there open discussion areas? Like really, because we're seeing that our providers are having to largely fund their education and training in pediatric feeding disorder. So I would also like implore people to be like really thoughtful consumers of education. Is it getting them that broad perspective? Does it include the family voice? That shouldn't be a fluffy add-on. That should be like a requirement for your education. So those were a couple of just my key pieces, but I'll pass it to Kelsey because I know she probably want to touch on the other areas.
Man, that was really good. you summarized it really well, Kyler. At the end of this publication, I hope that, you know, individuals reading it, I do feel like it should feel empowering and positive and hopeful that there's a lot of really great things going on in different settings. And like Kyler said, it's like really just a call to learn from each other, and across settings and across disciplines. And so what I'm thinking about kind of as next steps is like, how can I do better in my role to reach out to people in other settings and other disciplines, whether that's through my teaching or my research, and also out to families, and integrate, you know, more holistically all the stakeholders who are involved, even if it's in small ways. And then also how I can kind of, like Kyler said, on the other side, be a consumer of a wider thing and not stay so narrow in my lane, and reach out, look for opportunities in different disciplines, connect with someone who, you know, and it doesn't hurt to just, people talked about just kind of like throwing an email out there to someone who like lives nearby, but is in a different setting, and starting to build those community connections and branching out from there, I think is really valuable and hopefully is something that people take away from this.
Yes. Thank you both. Such incredible takeaways. And it is such a positive publication in terms of what are tangible opportunities for how individuals can advance within this greater system that we know we need to kind of like continue to work on and change. And that's one of my questions for you, Kyler, because at Feeding Matters, you spend a lot of time really vision setting for how does education need to transform? And you've done a lot to really think about that from all of these different perspectives. How do you feel like this work that you did with Kelsey influences how you're thinking about it from the broader Feeding Matters perspective?
Gosh, every time we dive into the subject of education, I feel like we're getting a clearer and clearer blueprint of where we need to go moving forward. It is clear that it needs to be cross-discipline. It is clear that it must include families from conception of education models through delivery systems. And I think it's really a true call for education to be, the infrastructure for education to be developed in with the foresight that it's a living, breathing education force. That if we are to provide evidence-based education across disciplines, it is living and breathing. We're going to have new publications roll out. It has to change and evolve. As we learn more from our families, as we learn more from different disciplines, as academic programs change and evolve, the education that follows those graduate programs needs to change and evolve as well. So from kind of like the system change perspective, we must have a connection or a hand in all of those different areas, in research, in clinical care, across all practice settings, in the families who are the ultimate, you know, measure of success, and down to the individual provider level. So I kind of see it as that we need a connected infrastructure to develop more comprehensive and applicable education pathways.
Great. Thank you both so much. Is there anything I missed in what you wanted to really capture and share as we work on disseminating this publication?
I just want our community providers and our families to know that they are a source of education, that every conversation they have, if you're the family, every conversation you have with that provider, you are teaching them and you are shaping them. And we thank you for having a voice and being brave in those conversations, because it truly makes a difference in how that provider works with the next family. And on the other side of the coin, to our providers, thank you for being willing, one, to participate in this research and, you know, be so transparent and brave in sharing your limitations and your strengths. And we just hope that you're on this journey with us of improving care through how we work with families. So I just like to say thank you for everybody listening.
Completely agree. And thank you both for shining a light on this, especially in the literature when this is not something that gets published very often or a look into this very often. And so it really moves the needle on this type of work.
And thank you to all that are listening. We will see you next week. Thanks, Kyler and Kelsey, for joining Haley and I. Everybody have a wonderful day.
Bye, everyone. Thanks.